It is Friday, September the 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, U.S. protesters from all walks of life take to the streets following police shooting of an African-American man.
The protests we've seen are very diverse. I would say, you know, it's about half and half. And definitely some Latino and some Asian protesters, but it's not overwhelmingly African-American.
Police officer charged in another U.S. shooting, China's space exploration, plus something new from the world of country music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. We begin with continuing tensions in the U.S. city of Charlotte, North Carolina, where on Tuesday an African-American man was shot and killed by an African-American police officer. Police are contending 43-year-old Keith Scott brandished a gun. Kerr Putney is Charlotte's police chief.
There's your truth, my truth, and the truth. Some people have already made up their minds what happened. We've given multiple facts, and there'll be an update later this afternoon about more additional information we're getting. But that still doesn't change the mindset and the perspective of some who want to break the law and tear down our city.
Scott's family says he was unarmed and may have been simply carrying a book that he was reading. Chief Putney said they did find a gun, but didn't find a book. Meantime, there have been demonstrations since the shooting took place. VOA's Isha Sarai is in Charlotte and spoke with me late Thursday as she and VOA's Arash Arabasadi were out among the protesters.
We've marched over with them from Mayor Bearden Park to Trade and Tryon, which is kind of the center of Charlotte City. It's a pretty historic place where most of the protests have been going on the past couple of days. We've seen a lot of riot police. They're being dispersed, but no signs of tear gas or rubber bullets yet. The streets are pretty full right now. So far, nothing's turned violent.
Well, as we know, Isha, there was a protester shot the other day,
yes.
Justin Carr, 26-year-old guy. We now have learned that he's died, and I'm just wondering if that information has made it to the protesters. Do you know?
Sorry, has what made it to the protesters?
That Justin Carr.
Yes, as far as I know, one of the speeches made in the park before the protesters we were with began to march did acknowledge that that he was killed yesterday, or passed away this morning, excuse me.
Right. We also understand that the Justice Department here in Washington had indicated they were going to send down help in terms of peacekeepers of some sort. You've seen any evidence of that?
I haven't. From what I understood, it was, you know, really more of a political, you know, not so much on the ground, on the streets thing. I feel like it was in the single digits, but I'm unaware, but I haven't seen anyone from Justice Department out here.
Any indication from the protesters that they'll continue to do this for a while?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Some of the chants we heard earlier, you know, indicated we'll be here today, we'll be here tomorrow, we'll be here, I believe they said we'll be here every day until we outnumber them.
Mm. We also understand that many of them are wearing masks to cover their noses and mouths in case tear gas is used.
The majority of the protesters are either wearing masks, you know, either sort of a flimsy plastic one. Some of them are wearing actual gas masks, and those who aren't are wearing bandanas. But there was a tent of volunteers set up at the park before the protesters left to march, full of, you know, handing out masks as well as bottled water and some antidotes for tear gas in case anyone is tear gassed.
As you might imagine, because the man who was shot was that started all of this on Tuesday. The man who was shot was African American, and so you would expect that these protesters would be largely African American. However, I understand that there are many other people there as well.
Yes, definitely. You know, the protests we've seen are very diverse. I would say, you know, it's about half and half. And definitely some Latino and some Asian protesters, but it's not overwhelmingly African-American.
That is VOA's Isha Sarai out among the protesters in Charlotte, North Carolina. Shortly after I spoke with Isha, the mayor of Charlotte instituted a curfew, which went into effect at midnight local time. Prosecutors in the U.S. city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, have charged police officer Betty Shelby with first-degree manslaughter in the death of 40-year-old African-American Terrence Crutcher on September 16th. A video recorded by a dashboard camera and a police helicopter shows Crutcher with his hands up, appearing to comply with police officers and leaning against his car. He is then shot by Officer Shelby and falls to the ground. The footage shows doesn't actually show a clear shot of when Shelby did fire the single shot that killed Crutcher. After the announcement of the indictment of the police officer, Terrence Crutcher's twin sister, Dr. Tiffany Crutcher, spoke alongside her family with reporters in Tulsa.
While we are pleased to learn that the officer who senselessly killed my beloved twin brother will face criminal charges for her reckless act, we understand that nothing will bring him back. Nothing will bring back our father, our son, our brother, our nephew, our cousin. Our goal now as a family is to ensure that this never happens to another innocent citizen. In spite of this news, our hearts are heavy right now. We lost a wonderful soul, but rather than focus on the reprehensible actions of one member of the law enforcement, today we choose to celebrate Terrence's life.
Yes.
And then Dr. Crutcher went on to say,
the chain breaks here. We're going to break the chains of injustice. We're going to break the chains of police brutality.
Yes, yes, yes.
The chain breaks here right in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so I'm challenging everyone from all different walks of life to join with us as we continue to move forward.
The attorney for the police officer charged with manslaughter has said that Terrence Crutcher was not following police commands and that Officer Shelby feared for her life and opened fire when the man began to reach through the window of his car. But the victim's family has discounted that claim, saying the father of four posed no threats to the officer. They also pointed to an enlarged photo from police footage that shows that Crutcher's window was closed, and police said Crutcher did not have a gun on him or in his vehicle. If convicted, Shelby could face a minimum of 4 years in prison. Among the many other stories we're staying on top of, a police deal with notorious warlord takes place in Afghanistan. Somali militants attack a Kenyan police station, plus a prominent Chinese rights lawyer jailed for 12 years. Expanded coverage of those stories, a lot more, at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. We turn now to U.S. politics, where polls have shown the presidential race between Republican Party candidate Donald Trump and his Democratic Party rival Hillary Clinton are tightening. Of importance this year are the so-called swing states, or battleground states, which can play a significant role in the election's outcome. Midwestern state of Wisconsin is one of those states. VOA's Sarah Williams speaks with Barry Burden, a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Professor Burden explains the importance of these so-called swing states.
The president is chosen by the Electoral College. Even though we count up the popular vote nationwide and there's a lot of attention to national polls, the winner is actually selected by a majority of electors. And each state gets a certain number of electors that reflects, in part, the population of that state. So states with more people have more electors. Some states are not battleground states because they're very likely to either favor the Republican candidate or favor the Democratic candidate and give those candidates all of their electoral votes. That means that the campaigns are free to focus on a smaller number of states that are really up for grabs, where either party could win. And typically that's between 5 and 10 states that we call battlegrounds or swing states.
Now, your state, Wisconsin, is one of those. At the moment, and I know I'm sure polls are going up and down, but at the moment, is Wisconsin leaning in any particular way?
It has been leaning throughout the campaign. In fact, I think every poll I've seen has shown Hillary Clinton ahead of Donald Trump. And that's been true from the primaries through this month. But what's also been true is that many of those margins have been quite close. And in the last couple of weeks, it looks like it's tightened up to the point where Clinton might only be ahead by 4 or 5 percentage points.
And what could you attribute that tightening? What's responsible for that, do you think?
Well, I think it reflects a little bit of the tightening that's been happening nationwide as Republicans who were reluctant about Donald Trump's candidacy have come around to him. He's now getting about as many Republican votes as Hillary Clinton is getting Democratic votes. So the levels of loyalty between the two parties have essentially evened out. And I think there have been some concerns about Hillary Clinton's campaign, whether it be the Clinton Foundation ties or the email server or the other controversies that have just continued to make some voters reluctant about her. And that all has been just enough to bring down the big margin she had after the Democratic convention down to a closer race in Wisconsin and around the country.
Now, there are two well-known Republicans from Wisconsin, the governor, Scott Walker, also the Speaker of the U.S. House, Paul Ryan. In the past, Wisconsin has had such well-known senators as Joseph McCarthy, a Republican, but also a Democrat, William Proxmire. They were all very well-known politicians. So I guess, you know, has Wisconsin kind of generally followed one party or the other, or it's pretty much been evenly divided?
It's been a divided state. It often looks one way in midterm elections and looks another way in presidential elections. On the one hand, the state has a remarkable streak of now voting for the Democrat for president in 7 consecutive presidential elections. That's actually one of the longer streaks in the country. Despite that, it's considered a swing state in most years because the Democrat didn't win by a lot in many of those elections. Some of them were quite close, especially the two Bush elections in 2000 and 2004, where he narrowly lost the state. And in fact, those were elections where Democrats won nationwide. 2 of those were Obama elections, and 2 of those were Clinton elections in the 1990s. So it is a streak of Democratic wins at the presidential level, but many of them have been close. And it's a very different story in midterm elections. In the 2010 and the 2014 midterm elections, Republicans did very well here. Governor Scott Walker won initially in 2010 and was reelected in 2014. Republicans won control of the state legislature in 2010, and they picked up 1 of the 2 U.S. Senate seats by electing Ron Johnson in 2010. So it really is a complicated state when it comes to partisanship. It seems to lean a little bit blue in presidential years and lean more red in midterm years.
That is Barry Burden. He is a professor of political science, also the director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. By the way, VOA will carry live the first face-to-face debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Join us on Tuesday, September the 27th at 1 hour Universal Time. This is VOA.
Know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and 2 advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. China took a major step recently, in fact about a week ago, sending its 2nd space lab, Tiangong 2, into orbit. Next month, Beijing plans to send 2 Chinese astronauts to the lab, part of a broader objective, one catching up with the achievements of and potentially overtaking the U.S. and Russian space programs. My colleague Michael Lippin discusses the ambition of China's space program on his latest VOA China 360 podcast with planetary scientist Pascal Lee of the California-based Mars Institute. Lee says one inspiration for China has been the U.S. space program's Apollo program that sent the first humans to the moon in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
The biggest benefit of the Apollo program was not the return of lunar rocks, which is what it did in practice. The biggest benefit was the fact that it bred a whole generation of younger scientists and engineers who then went into these cutting-edge fields and are now the foundation of an economic boom in the United States. So this is actually well documented. You see a spike in people enrolling in graduate programs in science and technology, engineering and math, when there is an exciting space program like the Apollo program was at the time in the country. And so China is experiencing just that. The nation is enthralled by this effort for China to catch up and go into space. And the biggest benefit really is the fact that there's a new generation of young scientists, technologists, engineers, and mathematicians rising in China.
Well, how do you think planetary scientists such as yourself in the U.S. and the West look at this effort by China to kind of excite its people about space? Do they see it more as something complementary to their own efforts to explore space, or is it more a case of, you know, China is our competitor, so we have to kind of keep an eye on what they're doing?
That's interesting. For me personally, as a scientist and as a human being, space exploration is sort of the more the merrier type of thing. The more humanity focuses on advancing the space frontier, the better off we will be ultimately as a human species. Having said that, the immediate consequence, of course, of anything like this is that it keeps existing space programs on their toes, to the point where in the United States there actually has been a congressional mandate for NASA not to collaborate technically with China in space. And this is sort of a double-edged sword in the intent of this exclusion of China. China, for example, wanted to be part of the International Space Station, and the European Space Agency, which is a major partner on the space station, was strongly behind that, was supportive of that. The United States essentially vetoed that because Congress vetoed that. And the fear is that China might acquire technology and know-how from rubbing shoulders with the United States and the space station program. And that was viewed as being something that would not serve the interests of the United States. But the other edge of the sword is that when you exclude a partner, a potential partner like this, you also give it free rein to try to establish alliances of its own, to invest in technologies that it would have otherwise not acquired on its own, and to essentially become even potentially a stronger competitor. So I think excluding China from the United States perspective might have a short-term benefit, but it's really being outrun at this point, from my perspective, by the drawback, which is the fact that China and other space agencies now are working together. The United States might find itself more and more alone in what it's doing in space.
That was planetary scientist Pascal Lee speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. You can hear more of their conversation by checking out Michael's VOA China 360 podcast. You can go to voanews.com. It's there. Also on Twitter at VOA China 360, and it's for free on iTunes. It is time now to see what's happening on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Gee, there was an incident in Milan, Italy, which involved a high-profile American celebrity. What was that all about?
Hi, Steve. Gigi Hadid, one of the two Hadid sisters, was physically harassed in Milan, where the Milan Fashion Week is taking place. You can watch the clip from the Twitter account @HadidNews that follows both Gigi and Bella Hadid. It's quite clear in the video that he literally grabbed her from the back and lifted her up before she elbowed him. And of course, that news in and of itself is quite shocking, but it's actually how the entertainment media outlets have portrayed the incident that got people talking about it online.
So it's putting the blame on Hadid, right? Uh-huh. What's the online reaction like?
That's right. Twitter users are saying that it's quite scary that she was quote-unquote assaulted by a man, and now she's being criticized for it. The man in question is confirmed as Ukrainian prankster Vitaly Siduik, who is known for harassing American celebrities.
Ah, the guy who also got into trouble for harassing Brad Pitt and Bradley Cooper. What was his motive this time?
Yes, so his alleged motive is because Hadid has nothing to do with high fashion as a, in his own words, well-connected cute girl from Instagram.
And what about other subjects out there trending on social media?
A video clip from the questioning of U.S. Bank Wells Fargo CEO John Stump by the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs is trending. It's been 2 days since the event took place, but people are still talking about him being grilled by Senator Elizabeth Warren. The testimony was in relation to fraudulent accounts opened by Wells Fargo employees to jack up its share prices. Her questioning of Stump received well over 9 million views so far on her Facebook page alone. Many commenters, especially former Wells Fargo bankers, applauded her for asking him to resign, but Stump said in the video that he does not think the practice in question, which was excessive cross-selling, was a scam. Steve?
Hey, many thanks to you, G, International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Rosé wine is blushing in business.
We're talking almost 3 billion bottles of rosé have been produced in the world in the last year, most of it in France and in the United States.
Dan Fredman, Malibu Coast Vintners and Grape Growers Alliance says people love rosé.
People love it. It's easy to drink.
The Nielsen Data Agency says rosé wine sales this year in the U.S. shot up 39% compared to 2015. And wine drinker Lamore Galler says the pink is versatile enough to mix with ice.
Rosé makes me feel happy. It's light, it's crisp. I love the bubbles.
A fourth of those drinking rosé today range from 21 to 35 years old, but overall rosé exports to the U.S. are up nearly 60% this year. Winery owner Ron Simler explains how it happened.
The American public has finally decided that it's okay to drink rosé, and they probably got their hint from the French.
Cheers. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. The British country music duo The Shires will release their latest album. It's called My Universe later this month. Their first album, Brave, drew much acclaim, and as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the pair has gone from obscurity to stardom in less than 3 years.
You only get one life.
The Shires is vocalist Chrissy Rhodes and singer-musician Ben Earle. They became a group in 2013 when Ben, a solo artist who had toured with Katie Tunstall, posted the message, "There must be a country singer somewhere," on his Facebook page. Chrissy responded, and The Shires was born. The group was invited to 2014's Country to Country Festival and performed outside London's O2 Arena. They got their first airplay on BBC Radio for their first single, Nashville Grey Skies. Their first headlining tour came in 2015, and they released their first album, Brave, in March of last year. The album peaked at number 10 on the UK country charts. Now they have played sold-out dates across the world and landmark performances at the Glastonbury Festival and Nashville's Grand Ole Opry. Chrissy and Ben say playing the Opry was like living out a dream.
As country musicians, I think you dream of playing on that stage, and to be able to do that so early on in our career, you know, like pretty much 1 year, wasn't it? And that we were on that stage. We'd love to go back again and redo it, and like just so that we can enjoy that moment even more, because it was just, we were a ball of nerves at the time.
And it's kind of like an out-of-body experience, because, you know, in our heads, that is kind of the pinnacle in a lot of, you know, ways. It's the kind of thing you say, oh, one day we'd love to play the Grand Ole Opry, that would be our dream. And then, like Chrissy said, a year and a half later, to be on the stage, it's like your brain almost can't process that in a way.
The Shires have also been working on their sophomore album, My Universe. Chrissy Rhodes says the group began working on the new album when they had just released their debut CD, Brave.
We went away to Nashville for 3 weeks to go and write out there. We were writing pretty much every day when we were out there, and you know, we got quite a lot of songs when we were there. And then when it came to the process of deciding which ones we were going to go and record, you know, we had about, I don't know, 35 really strong contenders for the album. So that, you know, that was difficult to try and decide which ones were the ones that were going to be recorded. And then as soon as we'd recorded them, we had to decide which ones were going to make the album. And nothing's felt so difficult so far.
The Shires have released one single from the new LP, Beats to Your Rhythm, which features an infectious hook and which the duo has described as perfect for driving around in a convertible car. Chrissy Rhodes says their second single, My Universe, is a mixture of pop and country, but still holds true to its UK roots.
It's on the poppier side of country music, I think. It's still got the kind of, you know, storytelling in it as well. But we have a couple in the video that act out a kind of storyline, and we're in between kind of performing the song as well. So, yeah, it's a big step up, I think, for the next video.
The Shires are currently touring the UK in support of their new album. They announced on their Facebook page that My Universe will come out a week early on September 30th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And one other item, President Obama has paid tribute to a number of people, including comedian Mel Brooks, author Sandra Cisneros, composer Philip Glass, a lot more at a White House ceremony. 24 artists, writers, playwrights, performers awarded the National Medal of Arts and Humanities. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Thomas Blondet, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the U.S. State Department is offering up to $5 million for information leading to the location or identification of ISIL terrorist Tirad al-Jarba, better known as Abu Muhammad al-Shamali. Al-Shamali is a Saudi national who was born in Iraq in 1979. He has been associated with ISIL since 2005, when it was known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He now serves as a key leader in ISIL's Immigration and Logistics Committee and has been facilitating the travel of foreign terrorist fighters from Gaziantep, Turkey, to the border town of Jarablus in Syria. Al-Shamali and the Immigration and Logistics Committee coordinate smuggling activities, financial transfers, and the movement of supplies into Syria and Iraq from Europe, North Africa, and the Arabian Peninsula. In 2014, Al-Shamali facilitated the travel from Turkey to Syria of prospective ISIL fighters from Australia, Europe, and the Middle East, and managed ISIL's processing center for new recruits in Azaz, Syria. In September 2015, the United States Department of the Treasury placed al-Shamali on its specially designated nationals list for acting for or on behalf of ISIL. On the same day, he was also sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council, which imposed a travel ban, asset freeze, and arms embargo on al-Shamali. Since its inception in 1984, the U.S. State Department's Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If you have information on Abu Muhammad al-Shamali, contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at rewardsforjustice.net. Email at info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone at 1-800-877-3927, or mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
is for